you all bow with me as we ask for a blessing? Dear Heavenly Father, we're so grateful that we could all gather together during this Feast of Unleavened Bread. I'm sure we can all agree that we've made some really good memories here. We've been blessed with the fellowship. We've been blessed with the food, with the unleavened bread. Father, as I deliver this message, I pray that you'll guide my heart, guide my thoughts, guide my words, Father, and that you'll give us a desire to seek after wisdom and understanding, Father. And understanding so that we can better prepare for what's coming. We're always grateful, Father, for the sacrifice of your Son, and it's in Yahshua's name that we approach you as we say amen and hallelujah. Am I good? All right. So I'm going to start by briefly acknowledging the conflict in Israel. Not for dramatic effect, but because it is relevant to my message. 175 days ago, this was on October 7th, a tragic incident unfolded during the Nova Music Festival in Israel when Hamas militants launched an attack, killing about 1,200 people, and an additional 248 individuals were taken hostage. This event heightened tensions and led to increased hostilities between Israeli security forces and Hamas militants in Gaza. The death toll continues to rise and is estimated now to be at over 32,000, with many, many more injured. In the middle of January, marking the 100-day anniversary of this conflict, a spokesperson for Hamas made a statement regarding the purpose behind the attack, and this statement raised some eyebrows. Just a few weeks ago, and this is kind of what prompted this message, CBS News, which you know I would consider mainstream media, referenced this speech in an article posted online with the title, "What These Red Cows from Texas Have to Do with War and Peace in the Middle East." Here's an excerpt from the article, and I've got it up on the screen here. When Hamas spokesperson Abu Ubaidah began a speech marking the 100th day of the war in Gaza, one confounding yet eye-opening proclamation escaped the headlines, listing the motives for the Palestinian militant group's October 7th massacre in Israel. He accused Jews of bringing red cows to the Holy Land. The cows he was talking about are red heifers, which now graze at a secure, undisclosed location in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Some Jews and Christians believe they're key to rebuilding the Jewish temple that once stood in Jerusalem and to beckoning the Messiah. And I don't think anyone here, not CBS News even, is saying that these red cows are the primary cause of the current conflict, because we all know there are deep-rooted causes that go back decades. But they represent something that has the potential to escalate the conflict even further. And if you're unfamiliar with the significance of the red heifer, or like the title of this message suggests, the mystery of the red heifer, I think you're in for a surprise, because many see it as a sign that we're getting close to the end times. So today, what I'd like to do is explain three things. First of all, why the red heifer is so important to Judaism, and then by extension, the Islamic faith, where the practice of killing the red heifer originated, and why, and you're going to find out it's from the Bible, and why, even though we don't perform animal sacrifices today, we, this group here, and a lot in Christianity, are interested in how this fits in with end-time prophecy. But let's go back a few years to learn about the origin of these cows. In September 2022, the Jerusalem Post published an article about five red heifers arriving in Israel from, well, of all places, Texas. I have an excerpt from this article up on the slide. "The heifers are all under 1 year old, and if they remain 100% red and avoid any blemishes which would disqualify them, they will each be eligible to be used to create the ashes required by Jewish law to purify those who have come into contact with a dead body," explained the Temple Institute on Monday. So they were interviewing representatives of an organization called the Temple Institute. This level of purification would be needed in order to allow the Kohanim, which are priests, to carry out their work in a future temple. This article, again, this is about a year and a half ago, September 2022. This article also states that the farmer that raised these cattle is a devout Christian who was intensely interested in this commandment, and he began breeding the cattle for this trait. He said in an interview, "I didn't set out to do this, but right now I'm probably the best red heifer hunter in Texas. The Bible says to bring a red cow to purify Israel, and I may not understand it, but I'm just doing what the Bible said." Now, why would Hamas care about this? Why would Hamas care that a farmer in Texas has raised these five red heifers and that they've been shipped to Israel? I have an English translation of the video that was posted by Hamas, and it's still on Twitter. I mean, you can go out and find it, and there's additional videos too. But I'm not going to repeat it all, but I am going to pull the excerpt where he mentions the red cows. He says, this is the Hamas spokesperson, he says, "And the bringing of the red cows as an application of a detestable religious myth designed for aggression against the feelings of an entire nation in the heart of its Arab identity." And so there you get a clue about why Hamas or even those Muslims in general might take offense to Jews moving forward with this. I mean, they feel like any step that Israel takes towards rebuilding the temple is an act of aggression. They see it as a threat on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we'll talk about that in a minute, which they consider a holy site, to establish the temple on the Temple Mount, which many Jews believe was the original site of the temple. They would need to replace the existing mosque. So you can start to see why the construction of the third temple would either, I mean, this is what I see, is it would either start a large-scale war between Judaism and Islam worldwide, or may only be able to happen as a result of a war that was already going on, where there was a shift of control from, the Muslims over to Judaism there on the Temple Mount site. I've got a picture here to kind of show you. This is an aerial shot of Jerusalem. And a lot of people think that that Dome of the Rock, the Golden Dome, is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but actually the mosque is in front of that. So this is a view of the Temple Mount from the south looking north. And so south of the Dome of the Rock, you can see a little gray dome there. That's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But this whole area here is where most Jews think that the temple was located, and this is where they're interested in establishing the new temple. By the way, we'll talk a little bit about the Mount of Olives later. It's not in this picture, but if you can picture it off to the right, it would be to the east of this. The Al-Aqsa Mosque here, that's pictured here, is said to be one of the holiest sites in Islam. Of course, Jews would counter that the temple is the single most holy site in Judaism, if it were still around. And I believe they see that Temple Mount there, pictured here, as their most holy site. Some might even say it's the Western Wall, which is pictured here. I don't have an arrow for it. I think there'll be a slide later that points out where the Western Wall is. But it's on the western side of the square. Even though many Jews think the Third Temple should be built right where the Dome of the Rock is, some actually do believe that it's not right there on top of that, that it's at some site around there. This ministry has actually published a few videos that present evidence that the temple was located to the south of this mosque. So it would be in an area that's not pictured, but I wanted to put a plug in for the Lost Temple Mount. So you can go on YouTube, and if you search for the Lost Temple Mount, this is the first result that comes up for me. I'm sure it'll be in the top results if you're interested in learning where we think that the temple originally stood. You can see in this thumbnail, Elder Randy's there with Elder Don Esposito, and they're kind of pointing off to the south of the Temple Mount location. And here's the other slide that I have that I pulled from our website, and I'm sure Ryan probably put this together, but from this angle, it kind of looks like we're on the Mount of Olives. Well, I see Mount of Olives kind of pointed here, so maybe we're above the Mount of Olives, but you can see the gold dome in the background. You can see the Western Wall's kind of pointed out there. And then we show evidence in that video that the temple may have been located to the south of all of this, to the south of the Temple Mount. So if you're interested in that, you can find more information on our website or go to YouTube and find sermons or find the video that I just plugged. But, I mean, even if, like, the Jews that are interested in building a third temple, even if they accepted this as the location, like they understood that this was the location, I am still doubtful that there wouldn't be conflict. Because the temple here, you can see it's still really, really close to that Al-Aqsa Mosque. And it would be hard for me to believe that a temple could be built there and there would still be peace in this area. So this is one of the reasons why Islamic militant groups and even the greater Muslim population would care that the Jews now have red heifers and that Jewish groups like the Temple Institute, you know, they want to use those red heifers to perform this purification process. In fact, here's a excerpt from the Temple Institute website. It says, for GOD has ordained that its ashes, and those are the ashes of the red heifer, alone are the single missing ingredient for the reinstatement of biblical purity, and thereafter, the rebuilding of the Holy Temple. So they've got it all laid out on their website, and it's really easy to find. And at a high level, you start to understand then what the importance of the red heifer is, and especially those ashes, and how they're required for a purification process. And so I made a really simple slide to help me understand it. So the process is the red heifer is brought, kosher red heifer is brought, it's burned, and the ashes are mixed, and we'll read about that mixture in a few minutes. It's used for purification of the people that would be building the temple, but also purification of the vessels that would be put into the temple. And then that would lead to the construction of the third temple. But why is it so hard to find a red heifer? Maybe you didn't know. Maybe you didn't realize how hard it is to find a red heifer. I mean, if that's what is needed, why hasn't it happened up until now? When I was younger, probably a teenager, I would hear about the red heifer, and I would get this little knot in my stomach. And I don't know, maybe some of you have that knot in your stomach right now, because this was always mentioned in the context of the tribulation. And every time a red heifer was found, it was like a sign that we were getting really close to the end of the age, which meant, you know, we were going to have wars and rumors of wars, and that destruction, you know, that now we're kind of shielded from would find its way here. I mean, a worldwide war would actually affect us here in the U.S. And, you know, at the time, and even now, I feel like I'm relatively shielded from all of this. I get up, I don't have to worry about someone, a missile strike or militants coming in and you know, killing me and my family. But now we've got five red heifers, and actually I think one of them has been disqualified. It's possible either one or two have been disqualified already. But we've got five red heifers that are ready for the sacrifice. And we'll talk a little bit more about why they're ready for the sacrifice. But not only do we have the red heifers, we've got mainstream media bringing more awareness to this, where even you've got a farmer in Texas who is raising these cows for that trait. He's actively trying to breed them. So it feels like we're closer than ever. There are several times over the past 30 years when a red heifer was identified that could serve for the sacrifice, but later a blemish was found. You know, whether they found a patch of white hairs or a patch of black hairs or some other blemish. And I have a couple examples. This is from 1997, and you can see this classic retro CNN late 90s website where they have an article called Red Cow at Center of Israeli Holy Row. And the subtitle is Melody, and Melody's the cow's name. She's in the thumbnail there. Is Melody a sign of the Messiah or a threat to peace? And so they were even questioning this back in, I think it's 1997. Yeah, 1997. And I'll read the last paragraph that I have on the screenshot here. Under Jewish tradition, from the era when the Holy Temple stood atop Jerusalem's Temple Mount, the ashes of the red heifer, butchered in her third year, were mixed with water and used to purify Jews before they can approach the temple. So even back then there was awareness. CNN, I mean, how much more mainstream can you get than CNN? But here's another example from a little later, April of 2002, the original article was 2002, and you can see there was a red heifer born in Israel. Everyone was really excited about this, but then about 6 months later, it was disqualified because they found a blemish in it. And so it seemed like every time a new red heifer was found, and the rabbis would hold a magnifying glass and check it out, make sure it didn't have a blemish. Everyone got excited. And then later, you know, as these cows grew, there would be a blemish that would show up. But what makes it so hard to find a quote-unquote kosher red heifer? And then what is this process for purification that we keep talking about? And actually, I didn't realize there was a whole chapter in Numbers. I mean, I probably had heard this before, but I'd forgotten. There's this whole chapter in Numbers that talks about purification. And it goes through the process of this red heifer being slaughtered and what they would do with the ashes. And I'm going to read through parts of chapter 19. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But as we're going through it, I want to point out some very unique things about the way this red heifer was handled, because it's different than other sacrifices. It says in Numbers 19:1, Yahweh spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the ordinance of the law which Yahweh commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they bring you a red heifer without blemish, in which there's no defect, and on which a yoke has never come. And you shall give it to Eleazar the priest, that he may take it outside the camp, and it shall be slaughtered before him. And Eleazar the priest shall take some of the blood with his finger and sprinkle some of the blood seven times directly in front of the tabernacle of meeting." Now, this translation came from the New King James Version. That's usually the one that I try to pull my references from. But there's a couple of things that I want to point out here. First of all, you know, we're talking about a red, so it has to have a certain color. We're talking about a heifer, which is a female cow, so it can't be a male cow. And then there's other requirements, you know, no blemish, no defect, no yoke. It must not have been used for work. And the other thing that's interesting here is it was brought outside the camp. So most of the sacrifices we read about in the Torah, right, were done right on the altar. And this one was unique in that this calf was led, or this cow was led outside the camp, and not by Aaron, the high priest, because we're going to find out later that even going through this process made you unclean. And I suspect they appointed Eleazar so that Aaron, the high priest, could stay in the temple and perform his duties there. And it's not just the priest that's performing this. Anyone who's involved in this ceremony is unclean. Anyone who handles the ashes is unclean. And we'll read about that in a minute. But the King James here says, sprinkle some of the blood seven times directly in front of the tabernacle of meeting. Now, we just read that they're outside the camp, right, doing this. And so there's some speculation that this really should be translated like towards the front of the tabernacle of meeting, because otherwise the priest with the blood would have to run down to the tabernacle, sprinkle the blood, and we're going to find out that he would have been unclean to do that. And that was frowned upon. And we'll read a little bit more about that. So one commentary here, when it talks about this, it says that it seems to imply either that he carried a portion of the blood in a basin to the door of the tabernacle, so from the outside of the camp back to the tabernacle, or the act of sprinkling as he turned his face towards the temple, because he was disqualified through this defiling influence of the operation. So what they're saying here, they're pointing out that this process, going through this process, made you unclean, so you couldn't have a priest going back to the temple to sprinkle the blood. So I'm explaining all of this because there's an image here that kind of helps you visualize it. And I wanted to set this up. So we know from the Torah that the sacrifice happened outside the camp. And it sounds like he would sprinkle the blood towards the temple. So he would have to have a direct line of sight. And so this is an image from the Temple Institute. And they believe that this altar would have been constructed on the Mount of Olives, and that's where the priests were standing here, that there would have been a bridge that led right down to the temple. And so this is an artist's depiction of a ramp built between the temple and the mount where the priest would have a view right into the temple. And some of these details that this artist used, I found some of these details in Jewish writings. There's a collection of writings called the Mishnah Parah. and some of you might be familiar with it. Parah is the Hebrew word for heifer. So this collection of writings is just a whole bunch to do with this whole process and who carried it out, how it was carried out, and it mentions, for example, it mentions those arches there that you see in the rampway. Continuing on in verse 5, then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, in the sight of Eleazar the priest. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its offal shall be burned, offal shall be burned. And the priest shall take the cedar wood, the hyssop, the scarlet, and cast them into the midst of the fire, burning the heifer. Then the priest shall wash his clothes, he shall bathe in water, and afterward he shall come into the camp. The priest shall be unclean until evening. So there's where you see that reference to the one who's doing the ceremony is unclean. And the one who burns it shall wash his clothes in water, bathe in water, and shall be unclean until the evening. So even the people that were helping the priest were unclean until evening. And there's some irony in this process because we're going to find out in a few verses. This was meant to create a special mixture that would be used for purifying people when they came into contact with a dead body. And yet this process actually made them unclean, you know, and so they had to purify themselves. They were ceremonially unclean just for going through this process. And you may be wondering about these strange ingredients. They recently came up in a Bible study we were doing because, you know, there's other examples in the history of Israel where people have been sick and they followed a certain process and they were made whole. I think one of the prophets, it was Elisha, might have been taken like a fig paste or something, rubbing it into a wound. And we were kind of thinking, you know, maybe there's something going on here that we don't understand today. And if you feel like, you know, you're looking at this and you're like, well, this doesn't really make sense. Like, why would there be cedar wood? Why would there be hyssop? Why would there be this scarlet thread or scarlet wool? If you're thinking it's puzzling, you're not the only one. I found out that Judaism has a classification for laws like this that don't have an obvious explanation. They call them the chokim, and it's a word that means statutes. Right? And so they put the red heifer command into this category. Now, we understand today, and I hope I'm making this clear, we understand today, especially from the book of Hebrews, that the sacrificial system was a shadow of things to come, and that with Yahshua's sacrifice, there's not a need for us to carry out this process. But it's still important for us to understand that the Jews are planning to carry the same process out, follow the letter of the law, even if the reason isn't obvious to them. By the way, these cedar wood and hyssop, some speculate that they were used as an antiseptic or an antimicrobial, like they actually had healing properties. And in fact, you'll see these same ingredients listed in Leviticus 14 when you're purifying someone who had leprosy. You'll see the cedar wood and the hyssop mentioned there too. Continuing in verse 9, then a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes and store them outside the camp in a clean place. And I thought that was interesting too, because they burned this heifer, and I can imagine, you know, it's been reduced down to a pile of ashes. I don't know how heavy it would be, but they're put into a storage container and put outside the camp. They shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel for the water of purification. So anytime it is for purifying from sin. So anytime it was needed, it seems like they would go outside the camp, get some more ashes, mix it up, and then use that water, that mixture, for purification. And again, the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. It will be a statute forever to the children of Israel and to the stranger who dwells with them. So let me see here. Do I have? Oh, yeah, I'm going to continue on in verse 11. He who touches the dead body of anyone. So this talks about why they would need this and when this purification, this water purification be used. He who touches the dead body of anyone shall be unclean 7 days. He shall purify himself with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and he will be clean. If he doesn't purify himself on the third day and the seventh day, he will not be clean. And whoever touches the body of anyone who has died and does not purify himself, he defiles the tabernacle of Yahweh, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. He shall be unclean because the water of purification was not sprinkled on him. His uncleanness is still on him. So cut off from Israel. So this purification was very serious business. Without it, you know, if you touched a dead body and go through the purification ceremony, then you were to be cut off. I also read a tradition, Jewish tradition, that claims that any time a new red heifer was sacrificed for this purpose, that they take ashes from the previous one and mix them in. But it doesn't say that directly in the Bible. If you continue in Numbers 19, maybe you'll do that in your spare time. If you continue in Numbers 19, you'll see a reference to another specific scenario where someone dies inside their tent. And these ashes are brought out, they're mixed with water, they're sprinkled on the tent, they're sprinkled on the vessels inside the tent, and anyone who went into the tent while there was a dead person there. And so that gives a specific example there of, again, when this purification ceremony was used. So now, I mean, we understand the purpose. I mean, it was to purify people who had come into contact with the dead. And I read that death is considered the greatest defilement according to Jewish law. According to the rabbis, the highest form of ritual impurity was contact with the corpse. Some rabbis will admit that even today, this purification process should be followed regardless of whether there's a temple or not. So you can imagine, to make sure that they're in complete compliance, the Jews have additional guidelines to find, like the cow. First of all, we know the cow cannot be a calf, but a female, and they say it has to be at least 2 years, 1 month old, or I've also seen 2 years, 2 months old. So the five calves that were flown in from Texas, they should meet that age requirement now. And no blemish also means that farmer in Texas couldn't put the tag in their ear. He had to make sure to pull them off from the other cattle and not do anything to them that would disqualify them, you know, put any blemish in them. Something else I thought was interesting, I mentioned the Mishnah Parah a little earlier, but they claim that only nine red heifers, I mean, these writings claim that only nine red heifers have been sacrificed since the time of Moses until the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. And I have this list here, but, you know, it raises so many questions for me. You know, at the top of the list, the first one would have been under Moses, or Eleazar the priest would have done this red heifer ceremony. But number two, they have listed here, is Ezra. And there is a huge gap between one and two. I mean, if you don't understand that, Moses would have done it under the in the tabernacle, right? And then you've got the time of Israel going into the promised land. You've got the time of the judges. You've got the time of the kings. You've got the first temple, Solomon's temple, being built there. And it's hard for me to believe that, you know, Solomon wouldn't have had a priest in that temple, wouldn't have, you know, killed the red heifer, gone through this ceremony. So what I feel like is more likely here, they list Moses, Ezra, and then several others like Shimon Hasadik, which is Shimon the just. And, you know, they list a couple of other priests here, but I think that maybe these are just the known red heifers from history. And I think they were just better at keeping records after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the Second Temple. So maybe that's why we only have nine listed, because otherwise it's hard to explain why there's such a huge gap between one and two. Because, I mean, sure, the ashes were saved off to the side and used, but, I mean, over hundreds of years, it's puzzling to me that, you know, that this is accurate. So there's nine known red heifers. And then I also have a quote here from Maimonides. He was a Jewish philosopher, and he wrote all this stuff down around the year 1200. And he claims the 10th red heifer will be accomplished by the king, the Messiah. And I would just suggest kind of lock that away for a minute, because I think it's important that, you know, in Jewish thinking, they're not just building the third temple to build the third temple. I mean, they want to reinstate the sacrificial system, but I think they're also looking for a Messiah to come, someone who's anointed and a king to lead them. And I think that's also important to recognize. So, let's see. So does prophecy point to a third temple? So I'm going to transition over to talking about that, like the third temple and why we might be interested in a third temple being built, even though we don't follow the sacrificial system today. One reason this is of such interest to Christians and to people in our faith is we look to prophecies in the Bible, and they indicate that there will be a temple and a sacrificial system set up again before the end times. And before we talk about the third temple and prophecy, I want to give you a reminder about the first two. Now I'm looking at this slide and thinking it might be too small, but I've got the first two temples listed here, but I've also got the tabernacle listed off to, you know, at the beginning, because these temples were a model of, they were modeled after this tabernacle. And the first temple was built, it's called Solomon's Temple because it was constructed by Solomon, and it was really started by King David, his father. You know, David put a lot of time and effort into gathering all the materials for this temple, but Yahweh told him that he wasn't allowed to build it. His son would have to build it. And so if you look at the years here, you know, it's estimated it was built around 960 BCE, destroyed by the Babylonians in 586. You see that it was almost 400 years. It was around for almost 400 years, and for most of the time of the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, the temple stood there until the Babylonians destroyed it. And then, after the Babylonians destroyed it, there was about a 70-year period before the Jews were allowed to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And this one's called the Herodian Temple. The second temple is called the Herodian Temple, and I think it's because even though it was built a long time ago, around 516 BCE, King Herod, he kind of renovated it and expanded the temple grounds. So at the end of the life of this temple, it was known as King Herod's Temple, and I think we still refer to it as that today. This temple was probably renovated and enlarged about 20 to 25 years before Yahshua's birth. So in my mind, the second temple, a lot of it was fresh. When Yahshua and the disciples were walking around in Jerusalem, a lot of it was fresh. And yet, during his ministry, Yahshua has his disciples up there, and he's looking around at the temple, and he's saying, you know, not one of these stones will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. So you can imagine the surprise, people hearing this. Herod just finished this, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and you're saying everything's going to be ripped down, or actually it would be more than that, but you understand what I'm saying. What about the third temple? There's not a physical temple currently in Israel. As believers in Yahshua, we understand that we are temples, that Yahweh's spirit dwells in us. But that doesn't mean that the Bible is silent about a third physical temple. I just mentioned Matthew 24, but let me go there first. And there's only a couple scriptures that I'll point to in prophecy, because I want to make sure we all understand why we think that there is going to be a third temple rebuilt before the end of time. So Matthew 24, this slide starts in verse 15, but I'll read the first couple verses from my paper here. Yahshua went out, he departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. Okay, so there they were in the temple area. And Yahshua said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone will be left here upon another that will not be thrown down." And this was a reference to the destruction of this second temple by the Romans. And you know what? I don't even think I mentioned that on the last slide. So yeah, the second temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. Okay, so, and Yahshua predicted that that was going to happen. So starting in Matthew 24:15. "Therefore," this is Yahshua speaking, and by the way, they had left the temple by this point. They went up to the Mount of Olives, and so some people refer to this as the Olivet prophecy, because these are prophecies that were given on the Mount of Olives. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," and I've highlighted that phrase there, "whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. And then there will be a great tribulation such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless those days are shortened, no flesh would be saved. but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So there's a reference here Yahshua makes to Daniel, and you can find that in Daniel chapter 11, where Daniel prophesies that, first of all, forces are going to come against the temple. They're going to defile the fortress that's around the temple and remove the daily sacrifices and put something in place called the abomination of desolation. And that's what Yahshua mentions here. Some historians, I also believe that this was first fulfilled during the time of the Maccabees, when the great Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes, he outlawed the keeping of commandments and Jewish customs. The Jews kind of turned away and turned to pagan worship. We call that the Hellenization of Jews, I think, where they adopted all these Greek practices. And there's mentioned in Maccabees, in the book of Maccabees, a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering. Now, I also personally believe that it may have been fulfilled a second time when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. I don't have as much evidence of that, though. But the main context of Matthew 24 seems to be future state, so even future for us, because of what we read later in the chapter. And I'm going to jump down to verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He will send his angels with a great sound of the trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. So this seems obvious. I mean, it should be obvious to everyone. This is future state, right? So to recap, what Yahshua prophesied is that before his second coming, there would be a tribulation. There's a tribulation talked about here. Prior to that, we should be watching for the abomination of desolation, which the prophet Daniel says is accompanied by a force coming into the temple, the daily sacrifices ending, and then this placement of the abomination of desolation in the temple. For all of that to happen, there has to be a temple, right? Paul also references a great falling away that will happen before the second coming in his letters to the Thessalonians. And so this is the other verse that we use a lot to show that there's going to be a temple existing before the end times. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 1 through 4. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our master Yahshua the Messiah and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Messiah had come. What's interesting is the New King James, I'm sure I pulled this from New King James, has the day of Christ in there as though it were Christos, the Greek word, but it's actually kurios, which is usually translated in the English as Lord. So instead of day of Messiah, it might be better rendered as day of Yahweh, you know, as a reference to the Old Testament, which is a day of judgment. So I just want to make sure you're not too confused by that. As though the day of Messiah had come, or the day of Yahweh had come, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called Elohim or that is worshipped, so that he sits as Elohim in the temple of Elohim, showing himself that he is Elohim. Now, if I'd thought about it, I would have highlighted that phrase, because what the phrase where it says that he sits as Elohim in the temple of Elohim. So before the second coming, Paul says there's going to be a falling away, and an anti-Messiah type figure will establish himself in the temple as a mighty one or a deity to be worshipped. Paul says later in this chapter that he's going to come by the working of Satan with every kind of power, every kind of sign, and every false wonder. What I find interesting about this is that the Jews that build the third temple, they're going to be looking for someone who's anointed, a Messiah king to come, to rise up, to lead them. And perhaps they're going to find someone like the person described here by Paul. Yahshua also warns about this. We didn't read it in Matthew 24, but and I don't have it on the slide, but I'll just read what Yahshua says about the false prophets in Matthew 24. If anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, again, the anointed one, or there, you know, here's the Messiah or there. Do not believe it, for false messiahs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. And these, Matthew 24 really seems to sync up well with 2 Thessalonians. So there are a few reasons this ministry teaches that Third Temple is prophesied, and this is why some of us are watching to what happens in Israel with this red heifer. I believe that Yahshua provided clues to his disciples so they would know how to avoid being deceived by false prophets, but also so they could watch for the signs of destruction because it was coming soon. The Romans were, you know, there was about to be a revolt. The Romans were about to surround Jerusalem, destroy the temple. And, you know, because of Yahshua's words, there were probably a lot of his believers that saw these signs and said, hey, it's time to get out of here. It's time to leave Jerusalem. And today, I think we can learn from these same teachings and once watch for these same signs. So as I start to wrap this up, you may be asking the same question as me that I was asking when I was preparing this. What progress has been made on the Third Temple? You know, just how close are we? So as of writing this, those five red heifers were shipped to Israel. That was in 2022. From what I can tell, there are at least three or four that are still kosher and could serve for this process. So I don't think we've ever been this close. One rabbi I saw in an interview said that the sacrifice is being planned for Passover, which in Israel this year is being observed towards the end of April. The Temple Institute, the organization I mentioned earlier, they held a meeting this week to talk about this, to plan for this sacrifice, but I haven't seen any of those meeting notes published yet. This Temple Institute already has some of the furniture made. You can find photos on their website, and I just took a quick screenshot. Even if you're not interested in the rebuilding of the Third Temple, it might just be interesting to browse through to see what they've built, because you know they say that they followed the Torah exactly. Uh-oh. Hey, Ellie, can you help me find page 9? I found it. Thank you. Anytime I panic, I'm like, Ellie, I think I've lost something. I need your help finding it. Okay, so from their website, I took an excerpt from this page. It says, the Temple Institute has likewise called upon Israel's finest craftsmen and artisans and enlisted them in the historical task of recreating the sacred vessels and vestments. Every vessel produced by the Temple Institute is done in accordance with the precise instructions that were first handed down by God to Moshe. The vessels you are about to view are all fit and ready for use in the Holy Third Temple. May it be built speedily and in our days. So they're ready. There was another active group a few years ago that I was familiar with. They were called the Temple Mount Faithful. They had a cornerstone prepared and ready for the Third Temple. I mean, they were ready to put the cornerstone down. Sadly, their leader, Geshwin Solomon, he passed away in November of 2022, which coincidentally was just after those five red heifers were shipped to Israel. So maybe he got to find out about that, and that provided him a little bit of hope towards the end of his life. Since then, their website has been taken offline, but somebody probably still has that cornerstone, and they're ready to put it down. If you find an archive of their website, they very, very clearly claim that their goal is building the Third Temple. Yeah, and I don't have that on here, but I'll read it for you. This is their goal. The goal of the Temple Mount and Land of Israel Faithful Movement is the building of the Third Temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem in our lifetime, in accordance to the word of God and all of the Hebrew prophets, and the liberation of the Temple Mount from Arab Islamic occupation so that it may be consecrated to the name of God. So they were very clear that their intention and their purpose, this is the Temple Mount Faithful, was to establish the Third Temple where you know, the Temple Mount is. So with a sentiment like that, you might understand why the red heifer could be a concern to those in the Islamic faith and could escalate the conflict between Israel and Islamic militant groups. If they feel like the Al-Aqsa Mosque is threatened, I think that conflict could spread much further than just the land of Israel. In fact, I was just reading this last week that there's a risk of Israel spreading the conflict up to Lebanon, where the militant group up there is Hezbollah. You know, they might be declaring war soon. I don't know. They haven't done it yet. So it just seems like tensions are rising up there, too. So it's already seems like it's getting ready to spread outside the borders of Israel. But before I close, I did intend to find a way to connect the red heifer sacrifice to this feast, Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Elder Allen read this passage during the Passover memorial, but now that this process of the red heifer, we just covered this and it's fresh in our minds, I'd like to revisit this in Hebrews 9. Hebrews 9, verse 11. But Messiah, again, this is the anointed one, Messiah came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once and for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of the heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Yahshua, and I forgot to put Messiah in there, blood of Messiah, who through the eternal spirit offered himself without spot to Elohim, how much more will he cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living Elohim? And I've highlighted the reference there to the ashes of the heifer, sprinkling the unclean, those who had come into contact with a dead body. And so, you know, just how we learn that those ashes of the red heifer purified Israel from contact with death, this verse is asking us to imagine what the blood of Yahshua can do to purify our conscience of dead works, or those works that come from a corrupt source or an evil motive that lead to spiritual death. You know, so that we can serve Yahweh better. And it says, the living Elohim, so we can serve Yahweh with sincerity and a changed heart. While it remains important for us to watch for the fulfillment of prophecy, I hope that we remember that Yahshua's sacrifice is what holds the ultimate significance here. As we look forward to the restoration promised by prophecy, we can't lose sight of the power that Yahshua's blood has to purify and to transform us. So may Yahweh bless you as you search for wisdom and understanding so that you can prepare for the time ahead. Thank you for your attention. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.